Welcome to Still Scared Talking Children's Horror, a podcast about creepy, spooky, and disturbing children's books, films, TV, and games. Today we're talking about a selection of children's horror games spanning the last 30 years or so, and talking a little bit more in depth about the text adventure game Sci-Hi. A full transcript of this episode will be available, so check the show notes for that. Enjoy! Good evening, Adam.
Ahoy, ahoy there.
I said, I teased at the end of our last episode that we might be talking about branching into a new genre this episode. And we are.
You dangled the branch of possibility before them, and it wasn't just a plastic bit of old tat. It was a resplendent branch of truth.
Somehow this is the first time we're talking directly about games, which seems a little unlikely, but it is. I guess that there aren't that many children's horror games. Maybe we'll talk about that.
I don't think there are. So in preparation for this episode, I did some very cursory research, and I looked up some lists of best horror games for kids.
Yeah.
And frankly, I was disappointed and troubled because some of these games really they're only horror in as much as Monster Valley High toys are horror, you know, so like they've got the skin of a horror game, like Plants vs. Zombies, for instance. Those zombies stagger about like zombies, but they might as well be, you know, anything else, post boxes or robots, you know, or bits of old sausage. It doesn't matter. Like, they have, you know, they're slow. I guess that's what makes them zombies, but they're not there to be scary, you know, at all. Other games, which I just really don't think are kids' games. So Little Nightmares, I saw crop up.
Oh God, that's not for kids.
So I'm sure some kids have played Little Nightmares, but I don't know. Not only because the visuals, so if anyone doesn't know Little Nightmares, they're basically stealth platformers where you play a small little sort of elf-like child, trying to navigate these creepy environments and avoid these horrible, hulking, galumphing, shabby-looking sort of murderous chefs and other giant figures.
And it's a very troubling atmosphere.
Oh yeah,
it's pretty intense.
It's a really intense game, and the way they did the animation is that each of the body parts of the animated models were animated individually, almost like you used to do in Flash or something like that. So they all look weirdly disarticulated. Like, they don't quite move in the way you want them to move.
Yeah.
So they're really scary, and, you know, they've got a lot of deliberately very dark kind of thematic undercurrents. I wonder if people just think of them as kids' games because they've got the word little in the title.
Yeah.
And they have puppet-like graphics, and people are like, oh, puppets are for kids, so these are kids' games.
Yeah.
I did actually, so I started my teacher training, and I did hear a reference to a legitimate kids horror game in an English class just earlier today, as it happens.
Oh.
And remember, this isn't the first time I've mentioned kids games. So a couple of episodes back, I mentioned that I was in the primary school and that kids had tried to involve me in a conversation about who would win in a battle, Pennywise from Stephen King's It or Huggy Wuggy. So Huggy Wuggy is a kind of razor-toothed teddy bear from Poppy Playtime, which is very popular with kids. It's what you might call a mascot game. And I'll go back to those in a minute. But today, I didn't hear a reference to Poppy Playtime, but a different reference. So the kids in the class were discussing Ghostbusters, right? And one of the kids said, okay, well, they have like these vacuum cleaners that they suck up ghosts with. And a kid in the row behind said, no, that's not Ghostbusters, that's Luigi's Mansion.
Ah.
So Luigi's Mansion is a game series that I think it started on the GameCube. They're still being made, in which Mario's much maligned taller brother goes around a spooky mansion hoovering up ghosts.
Okay, yeah.
And that's what I think of as children's horror, that it's committed to its horror theme. You know, they're set in a haunted mansion and they really have a kind of ghost train-like feel.
Yeah.
So you've got this kind of creepy, haunted environment where ghosts pop out and they look a bit gooby and a little bit creepy. Yeah, there's nothing altogether horrific or unsuitable for kids, but it clearly is going for that kind of spooky atmosphere.
Yeah.
Where
do you stand on Halloween pinball?
So is that a specific pinball game, or do you mean Halloween themed pinball?
This was a specific pinball game that I think came with, well, I at least had it on a Windows 95 or 98 setup, and I enjoyed it very much.
I mean, is it as scary as the 3D maze screensaver?
I mean, what is, really, frankly?
Did it? Because I remember the UFO pinball, which was on Windows. So it must have been similar. Was it like a graveyard themed, or were there ghosts
you could
hit with the ball?
I think it had gargoyles. I think like the pinballs came out of the gargoyle's mouth, and so yeah, it had the spooky MIDI music.
Mm. I do like spooky MIDI music.
Yeah.
So yeah. I mean, I think the thing is, you said that there aren't many horror kids games. I think the tricky thing is that back in the 80s and early 90s, when games moved out of the arcade into people's homes, I get the impression that distributors really thought of all video games as potentially for kids, no matter how inappropriate. Because video games are a great way of marketing horror films, which kids would have no chance of seeing in the cinema, to impressionable young minds. So, you know, it took a little while for the rating system to be brought in for games. And, you know, I think there's still this idea, to an extent, I mean, less so now, because people have grown up with games, are still playing games as adults, right? But I think when we were kids, there was still a sense that video games were largely for children.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think, that's... you know, when something like Grand Theft Auto came out, you did still have parents buying it for their kids because they didn't really have a sort of sense of, well, this is really inappropriate. Because it's a game. So I think what's tricky is kind of, it's not quite like with fiction, right? Where you have children's books and young adult fiction and adult fiction. I don't know if it's always been so easily demarcated with video games.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I think Nintendo, perhaps, I mentioned Luigi's Mansion, and Nintendo, out of the kind of major players in the console market, at least, have tended to aim their consoles towards children. Now, obviously, they could have expanded out to a family market with the Wii. But if you think of, like, the Nintendo flagship games, like the Mario games or the Zelda games, they've tended to be aimed towards a young audience. So Luigi's Mansion is definitely aimed towards kids. And there were some games on the N64 that, while not horror games, were definitely horror adjacent or had really creepy atmospheres. So I don't know if you ever played Banjo-Kazooie.
No.
Okay, so I kind of replayed a bunch of these games on the Rare Replay on the Xbox Live Arcade over lockdown. So Rare were a game studio from up north, I can't remember where, possibly Yorkshire, but British game studio, and they made some really big N64 games like the GoldenEye game, for instance.
Oh, yeah.
But they also had their own properties. One of these was Banjo-Kazooie, and came out not long after Mario 64, which had a bit of a kind of slightly haunted, uneasy atmosphere, like a lot of those early 3D games did. And Banjo-Kazooie, straightforward, fun game. You got a bear called Banjo, who's a kind of dopey honey bear, and his hyperactive bird pal, Kazooie. And they go around to different kind of adventurous lands collecting puzzle pieces. There's a kind of haunted house zone of a cemetery, but it's not very creepy. Now, Banjo-Tooie, on the other hand, came out and was being developed when Rare were also working on the game Conker's Bad Fur Day. And Conker's Bad Fur Day is this really odd, unsavoury game where they try to kind of make a game aimed towards adolescents. So it's got this kind of cutesy aesthetic, but then lots of kind of smutty jokes.
Really? That's interesting. I inherited an N64 and games from my sibling. A while back, and we went to me and Mackie went to trade in a bunch of these games to get ones that we wanted. And Conker's Bad Fur Day ended up fetching about 50 quid.
Oh wow!
Yeah.
So somehow. I'm not that keen on it. It's got some interesting voice acting, and if you look on the Rare Replay, the main, I can't remember his name, I think Chris something, but the guy who designed the game, he's quite worse for wear at this point, to be honest. Being interviewed, he's clearly a man who has been a hard drinker through a lot of his life. Right? And he kind of talked about how Kong's Bad Fur Day was not autobiographical, but he put a lot of himself into it. So I think the kind of slight degeneracy of it, or you got a lot of kind of characters who are, you know, drinking too much or partying too hard, it comes across. And you got some great voice acting in it. It's a weird game. But anyway, at the same time, Rare were doing the sequel to Banjo-Kazooie, Banjo-Tooie. And it's really odd because Banjo-Kazooie has this really kind of fun, light-hearted feel. And I started replaying Banjo-Tooie, and I was playing Rare Replay with my partner Antonia during lockdown, and she described Banjo-Tooie as a hauntological video game. And I totally get what she means. So without getting too academic-y, like, the idea of hauntology is something that's eerie, right? So something that feels emptied out and absent, and that it's kind of haunted by a vision of the future from the past. So that's a strange idea. But Yeah, I think often early 3D games, because they have this sort of optimism about the new future of video games, but in retrospect look really janky, right? And they're often very empty because, you know, they only had so much memory, so they couldn't populate these environments.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so they often feel a bit weird and a bit haunted. And Banjo-Tooie is really weirdly dismal, right? So it's still kind of colourful, but the colours have all kind of curdled and turned nasty. So if anyone has seen the Tim Burton Charlie and the Chocolate Factory remake, the colours are a bit like that, or his Alice in Wonderland, that they're kind of garish but grey and dismal at the same time. So it looks really unhealthy. And it also starts with one of the main characters being killed.
So
the first game, Banjo-Kazooie, has a lovable mole called Bottles, who has these thick glasses, and Bottles gives you hints and basically helps you upgrade your moves. Bottles gets exploded at the start of Banjo-Tooie, and is then a kind of blackened ghost corpse for the rest of the game, and remains dead.
Wow.
So it's from the start has this really kind of oddly kind of negative atmosphere, and there's a lot of meta jokes about how Banjo and Kazooie kind of don't really want to be doing a sequel. so like they're kind of back, but they don't really want to be doing it. So the whole kind of tone's just really cynical. It's a weird game.
I'm looking at some screenshots of it. It's pretty damn ugly. I mean,
yeah.
N64 games in general are pretty ugly, but very blocky brown.
It's a very brown game.
Yeah.
And another N64 game that was kind of disturbing for its ugliness and just bonkers premise was Space Station Silicon Valley. And this is a real rare find now. This is a deep dive, Space Station Silicon Valley. So the whole idea of this game is that you're an astronaut with your robot companion who crash land on a disused theme park planet, basically. So this planet was Space Station Silicon Valley, and it was an entertainment complex populated by robot animals. But it's long abandoned, so all these robot animals have gone completely rogue.
Yeah.
When you crash into it, the astronaut, he gets knocked out, and the robot gets smashed to smithereens, but it's, mother chip, it's sort of central processing chip, flies into the air and lands in one of these robot animals. And basically, the main mechanic of the game is you play this little chip, right? And you have to jump between the animals and, I guess, inhabit their consciousness. So you're like a sort of parasitic computer chip, basically. So you have to kind of kill robot animals as the computer chip, taking over the bodies of these animals. And then when you've killed them, jump into them and puppeteer them and bring them back to life.
Uh-huh. And it is frighteningly ugly.
Oh, and it is astonishingly ugly. Yeah, it's one of the ugliest games I've ever played. It's horrid. Thanks for just repeating that, because it really is very, very ugly. Can you describe any of the character designs you're looking at?
I can try. There seems to be a kind of head and torso of a bear I think it's a bear, could be an orangutan, but instead of legs has a wheel, like a black and red wheel like on a Hot Wheels car, and has sort of triangles for fingers or possibly claws. And there's a lot of googly eyes, very unsettlingly round. manic eyes, I think, is a theme I'm sensing.
Yeah, it's a very googly-eyed game.
Yeah.
Actually, that's true of Rare games, too. Maybe that's the common theme of N64 games that unsettled me as a kid. Is very googly eyes, I think.
Yeah.
So the only other Rare game I wanted to mention, which is a lot of fun, is the unfortunately titled Grabbed by the Ghoulies.
What? Okay.
Which might be the reason for its low sales figures.
Huh.
We're just
that's
like,
a choice.
Yeah, it's a bold move, Rare. That's also available on Rare Replay, and it's a kind of interactive comic book where you explore a creepy mansion and have to pummel your way through hosts of zombies and ghouls and other undead spectres and spirits. It's a lot of fun. It's not so much to say about it apart from the fact that it is called Grabbed by the Ghoulies.
Yeah.
I don't think they even renamed it for the American market. if you look at horror games for kids today, I mentioned they seem to be mostly mascot games. And what I mean by that is video games that have, like, a marketable main character or antagonists. So I think the reason for this is because of the massive, massive success of Five Nights at Freddy's.
Mm-hmm.
So, Ren, have you played any of the Five Nights at Freddy's games?
Nope.
Do you know what they are?
Okay, I'll tell you what I think I know about Five Nights at Freddy's. Are you maybe like a security camera person or like a night watchman or something?
Yeah.
And you're watching screens of the security footage, but then there's lots of jump scares because monsters jump up on the screen. But the monsters are like haunted or animate automatons.
Yeah, absolutely. So you're the night watchman at Freddy Fazbear's pizza place. So it's like a Chuck E. Cheese-like themed restaurant with animatronic singing animals, basically. And the idea is that at night they patrol the grounds and try to stuff any unfortunate souls into themselves, and they get crushed by their exoskeletons.
Okay, yeah.
Due to some kind of bug in their system, and these games have loads of lore, you know. So I'm sure any fans of the Five Nights at Freddy's games listening are like, no, that's not why they're doing it. Actually, it's for these really complex reasons, because there's tie-in games. There's massive amounts of explainer videos online. Loads of internet lore, and there's quite a lot of these games as well. What's most interesting about them, perhaps, is that the creator started off making Christian kind of edutainment games.
Okay.
And that one of his friends sort of said, hey, you know, your character designs are quite creepy. Wouldn't it be fun if you made a horror game? And he did. To his great conflict, I think very conflicted feelings. It's fine. Like, you know, he's an evangelical Christian and basically found massive success making horror games for kids. And I've read interviews with him, and he clearly troubled his soul to some degree.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So it is for kids.
Yeah, it is for kids. There are lots of toys. It's very popular with kids, the Five Nights at Freddy's games. Poppy Playtime, which I mentioned, is like a really obvious attempt to cash in on the success of Five Nights at Freddy's. And there are a few other more interesting games that also have this kind of mascot element. So Bendy and the Ink Machine is another one. Where, a few years ago, if you'd go into, you know, some toy shops, you know, you would see, you could buy plastic figurines of Bendy, for instance. And my most favourite out of all of these, and actually I saw some plastic figurines from the game, and I'm kicking myself for not picking them up, because I suspect it was like a single run, is Baldi's Basics. Uh-huh. Have you heard of Baldi's Basics?
No.
Oh, I freaking love it. It's like, well, it's the kind of thing, and I say that, I haven't properly played it, to be honest. I just love the aesthetic, because it's very much a game made by a millennial who grew up playing creepy edutainment games. So the idea is, it's a maths edutainment game in which the instructor, Baldi, the teacher, gets increasingly incensed and unhinged over your answering of maths questions that incorrectly or otherwise, and then terrorises you.
That sounds fun, yeah.
Yeah. And so that brings me, by quite a torturous route, down to the fact that I think the games that seem to have creeped us both out the most as kids were edutainment games, right?
Yeah.
So how would you describe what an edutainment game is for anyone who doesn't know?
Well, I strongly associate them with borrowing them from the library.
Mm-hmm.
You'd go to the library and they'd have the edutainment games in one of the spinning racks in the CD-ROMs. And this was the era of CD-ROMs.
Yes. Right?
Edutainment and CD-ROMs go together.
Definitely,
And it would be games that are trying to teach you some maths or some spelling or about nature, or I mean, some are more more directly educational than others, I think.
Yeah, I mean, and some of these you might even get in school. So my friend Peter says he spent a lot of time playing the Crystal Rainforest, for instance, at school when he was a kid. And I think maybe my school had Granny's Garden or some kind of equivalent, which has this sort of infamously scary end screen. If you lose, you get captured by a witch, for instance.
Yeah.
And sometimes you'd get games within educational software, right? So Microsoft Encarta, which is what everyone used for their homework before they had access to the internet, which was a kind of encyclopedia on CD-ROM, had a game in it called Mind Maze.
Did it?
Yeah. You clearly didn't spend nearly as much time on Microsoft Encarta as I did.
I definitely used it for my primary school homework.
Yeah.
I don't remember the game.
Well, yeah, if you really wanted to test your knowledge on Microsoft Encarta, there was a kind of quiz set in a medieval maze.
Oh.
So you'd have to kind of click through. It did look a bit like that kind of 3D screensaver, actually. But you click through the screens of this maze. It was pre-generated 3D backgrounds, like mist or something. Not even that sophisticated, actually. I think they're probably just like completely still images. And you had to answer questions. And that was a bit creepy. But yeah, there was one edutainment game you kind of sent me a link to, or a link to a playthrough of.
Yeah, so this was a game called Forestia, which is a pretty obscure, I think it's a French game from 1998. Where there's a in a forest, there's a benevolent forest dad called Daddy Oak who sends you on quests, and it's mostly pretty tame, but it has this one level where everything gets quite strange, this it was really really quite memorable to me, and I kind of looked it up and found out that it wasn't just me that it made an impression on, because it has an entry on Reddit on our creepy gaming where they linked to this full playthrough. But I'll read a description from a user called Romeo, because it gives a good description of this creepy stage. It says, The game is split into different episodes or chapters that feature different scenarios. In one, it's the big tree's birthday and he's given many gifts. In another, a siren comes to the forest and all of its inhabitants are under some kind of spell until you help her make her way to the ocean. And then there's the Fire Mountain. In this chapter, you are transported to an apocalyptic alternate timeline in which all the scenes have this bright red tint as if they came straight out of a creepypasta, along with an eerie choir that never goes away. A dragon comes to the forest, as well as an evil wizard, and they announce the end of days, as a volcano threatens to erupt and kill everything. All over the forest you can find dead animals, and if you stand there, their souls leave their bodies. The best part is that this comes entirely out of nowhere. So far, all of the games had no mention of any apocalypse coming or anything bad happening in the woods. The chapter even starts out pretty normally, with Sam the Rabbit calling you to look at constellations. Then, when the next day comes, you're in hell. Just like that.
So did this really alarm you as a kid then?
Oh, I mean, I think I quite enjoyed it. I found it a bit... I like the novelty of it. But I think I was a bit older than some of these commentators. I was more in the sort of 10 to 11 rather than 5 or 6 sort of range. But it was... I mean, it was definitely very unsettling. I messaged my sibling, Willow, to ask if they had any comments to share with the podcast. And they said, "Oh my god, the rattle noise as the spirits left their tiny cobwebbed bodies, discarded like unloved dolls in the forest of bloody light, at once familiar and alien." So
that's lovely, thank you, Willow.
Yeah, upstaging me in my own podcast.
That's the texture of the week right there.
Yeah, it made an impression on both of us, that stage.
So, well, I think I haven't actually, I should have asked my brother about his memories, because the edutainment company that I think produced the most unsettling memories for me was a company called Mech, who ended up being amalgamated into Softkey. But when they were Mech, they made two games which really made an impression on me. Museum Madness and The Secret Island of Dr. Quandary. So Museum Madness is probably the most traditionally educational, in as much as it's set in a museum. But it's a museum that's been taken over by a malevolent AI. And so you have to break into the museum at night under cover of darkness and put the exhibits back together, basically. So it has a bit of a Westworld thing going on. So these sort of animatronic or... might not even be animatronic, they might just be mannequins, but have kind of come to life and think that they're the real historical figures.
Yeah.
So, okay. You know, the mannequin of Ben Franklin believes he's the actual Ben Franklin, and you have to help the Ben Franklin, you know, fly the kite to generate electricity or what have you.
Yeah.
So, yeah, some of them are sort of historically themed, and some of them are natural sciences themed, and so on. It has this wonderfully kind of eerie MIDI music, which definitely marks out Met games, particularly their even creepier game, The Secret Island of Dr. Quandary. So I got you to watch just the first sort of 3 or so minutes of the game. I don't know if you can sort of describe what you saw.
It was showing me a just like a photo of a gloomy day at a kind of sort of local fairground, kind of. It looked pretty shabby.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Really looks really kind of shabby and like run down.
Yeah, this kind of, that it's not like a good photo. It's like someone took an offhand photo with a disposable camera.
Yeah, yeah.
and it's kind of, it's got a Ferris wheel in the background, and some of the kind of carriages on it start sort of shaking in a way that's obviously manipulated in the carriages in the photo to shake, and it's sort of text coming up on the screen going, "Come on in, come to the fairground. Ignore the shaking of the carriage on the Ferris wheel. I'm sure it's fine."
So you go into the fairground.
Yeah, and then you have to choose.
Yeah, well, you're met by a figure.
Mm.
Right, did you see Dr. Grondry?
I think I skipped. I didn't actually see Dr. Grondry himself.
Ah, so it's got Dr. Quandary posing as a fairground barker.
Oh.
So Dr. Quandary is the kind of grubby bearded magician trickster figure of the game who curses you to the island, his secret island. But he's undercover as a humble fairground barker, basically. Mm-hmm. And yeah, he gets you to play this game called, I think it's Troggleshoot.
Yeah.
Which is a shooting game, right?
Yeah. So you have three very ugly dolls, and you have to hit one of them.
Yeah. Well, I think they're the prizes. You shoot the troggles, which are these little kind of gawping-faced creatures.
Yeah.
And they kind of shatter when it's hard to tell if they're alive or not. You shoot them, and then yeah, you win one of these dolls, and then the kind of doll face engulfs the screen.
Yeah.
And there's a sort of spot, and then the next thing you know, you're trapped. You are the doll, and so you're trapped in the body of the doll. And so the game is that you're on the island, the secret island of Dr. Quandary, and you've got to answer educational puzzles in order to escape. And the idea is you collect up these ingredients for a recipe, which you cook up in a big pot at the edge of the island, that you win from completing these puzzles. And then you boil up the soup, and when you drink it, the idea is that the doll's body kind of breaks apart and you're going to be returned to your human form. But most upsettingly, the game is on an endless loop.
Oh.
So when you do this, and I've completed it on beginner level, medium level, and hard level, so this is definitely the canonical ending, because this infuriated me as a kid, and I tried and tried thinking I could break the cycle. You were just returned to the start of the game, back in the fairground.
Oh, wow.
Once again, faced with the choice of being imprisoned in a doll. So you're imprisoned in the doll. You go through all these sometimes fairly tedious educational puzzles to escape. You escape, and you're just back in the horrible fairground. This is an awful eternal recurrence. It's like the job of learning is never done, right? You can never escape the educational cycle. This really frustrated me as a kid. Like, I thought I must be doing something wrong, like that there must be some secret ending I wasn't getting.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'd go back to this game in the hope that this time I would escape the secret island to Dr. Quandary. But yeah, I never did. I'm still on the island. In spirit.
I'm sorry to hear that.
thank you. I'm glad. I hope that some of the genuine existential angst came across there, because really bothered me as a kid. And I'm going to put some of the music from the game behind me, I think, so people can get quite how dismal the music for this game is. It's horrible.
Yeah, good. Yeah, I also have a request, if you can get the noise of the animals' souls leaving their bodies in Forestia. I'd appreciate
definitely.
Sprinkling that liberally throughout this episode.
Yeah, I mean, my stepkids have played a lot of games, and George, as I said before, is not ostensibly into horror. He does like adventure games, so I have got him to play a lot of the old LucasArts games, like Monkey Island, that I liked when I was a kid. He's been playing Broken Age, which is made by Double Fine, so that includes some of the people who worked for LucasArts, like Tim Schafer. as project lead on it. And Broken Age has quite a dystopian atmosphere to it, or setting. So you play these two kids, and one of them is on a sort of 2001 style spaceship, isolated from his parents and forced to go through these kind of asinine kiddie cycles where he has to like rescue teddy bears, for instance. So the idea is that this spaceship was set up to serve him when he was a little kid, and now he's like a teenager and still has to do it. And the girl in Broken Age is being sacrificed as a maiden for the maiden's feast. So these are sort of dragon-like monsters come along to eat up the maidens, and the society is just completely complicit in it. So that's got quite, it's got kind of young adult themes to it, I suppose. And some of those old LucasArts adventure games had their creepy elements, so I don't really want to do proper spoilers, but the ending of Monkey Island 2, LeChuck's Revenge, is kind of really infamously strange. And unsettling. It's such a good ending, twist ending, that I really don't want to give it away if no one's, no one's played it. The ending for Simon the Sorcerer 2, which I will spoil a little bit, basically Simon the Sorcerer is a kind of teenage, sassy sorcerer, and you have to battle this evil warlock, I guess, or evil sorcerer, in it, and you end up kind of trapped. He's called Sworded, something like that. And you end up trapped in his body, and he's in your body. And Simon kind of directly addresses you as the player at the end, and says, "Oh, you may be laughing, but Sworded is out there, and he's going to come into the real world, and he's going to get you." And that worried me a bit. And I was going to quickly mention Sierra Games as well. So Sierra were kind of the rival studio to LucasArts. Not really kids' games. I guess the fantasy games maybe were aimed for kids. So you might have heard like King's Quest.
Mm-hmm.
So King's Quest 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 and 8, I think. 3 is particularly punishing. So the thing about the Sierra games is that they would kill you off at the first opportunity. For really pedantic things. So it would be like you type in. So the early games, they had a text parser, but they were graphical. So you had to type to interact. So you might come across a tree and type, climb up tree, and you climb up the tree and get hit on the head with a coconut, fall off, break your neck, and that's the end of the game. And you didn't save, so you're dead. So, like, they're just really hard. Like, Police Quest was the worst for this, which hilariously throws you out of the game unceremoniously if you forget to put on your seatbelt. If you don't type it in, put on seatbelt when you get into the police car. And you get lectured by this police officer called Jim, who was like based on a real police officer, and Jim like has his leg up on the police cruiser and is now a good cop always puts their seatbelt on when they're, you know, out on patrol. Sorry kid, you're out of the game, or something. It just boots you out.
Fun?
Yeah, they're quite anti-fun, I would say. Like, those early Sierra games, they really feel like they just don't believe in fun. You know, that you're punished if you want to have fun. No, come on. It's not what we're here for. And Torin's Passage, which was specifically for kids, is quite creepy, because the idea is you start on this outer crust of the planet, but each world is like, it's like you go into the planet. So it's like each planet, within the planet, there are layers of different worlds. So it's like you kind of drill down into the planet, and then there are different societies, and it kind of gets more and more dystopian and dark as you get towards the core of the planet. Which, yeah, I thought was quite cool as a kid. And the final one I'll mention is a game which I never got to play, but I think I had like a trailer of it on another game. And I've never quite got the courage to play it because I find it so unsettling. A game by a studio called Amazing Studio. I think another French studio, actually. So I don't know if French studios are particularly good at making unsettling children's games called Heart of Darkness. Have you heard of this one?
No.
Yeah, I think this is like really forgotten, but it's horrible. So it's like a cinematic platformer. So I think it was made with motion capture or something. So the animation's really smooth. And you play a small boy whose dog is kidnapped by aliens. And so you have to go and explore this alien landscape to rescue your cute dog. And yeah, you're playing this sort of plucky young kid. And it basically predates the game Limbo by about, I don't know, 15, maybe 20 years. And obviously Limbo was kind of notorious for you playing a kind of kid and you die in horrible ways. But Heart of Darkness is way worse, frankly. Like, because it really looks like a kid's game. It looks, I think, really quite cute. Like, the design for the kid and the dog. Like, I could easily see parents giving it to kids. But as the child, you die in really horrid ways. Like, you know, you'll be munched and torn apart and your head popped off. I kind of recommend, I mean, it's, you know, it's not like X-rated or anything, but it's just like, it's just really brutal. I remember, say, I had a trailer of it, I think, on a different game, presumably an adventure game, maybe a Sierra game or something. And I think I must have just watched the trailer like once or something, and it just stuck in my mind for decades. I only discovered the name of the game like a few years ago by trying to find out what it was, because it made such an impression on me. So yeah, that's Heart of Darkness. So So yeah, you know, bits and bobs. I don't know if how many of these were technically horror games for kids, but
yeah.
But you wanted to do a quick kind of deep dive into, I guess, a kind of young adult text game, I'd call it.
Yeah. It's not, perhaps not more supernatural mystery than horror, although some roots are more or less creepy, depending on what choices you make. It's called Sci-Hi. By Rebecca Slitt, published by Choice of Games in 2014. It's set in a high school where some of the students have recently started gaining psychic powers, and you as a protagonist have a sort of side gig as an investigator, and you're asked to start looking into some of your schoolmates who are acting strangely, like suddenly becoming serious and studious, and you eventually realise that they're being mind-controlled by a device called a vinculum, that the principal and one of the teachers are powering with magic from a vector in the ocean called the Nexus. And you have to sort of choices to try and undermine this plan. They can either try and destroy the vinculum or try and reverse its powers and various things. But and in most of the endings, you get a showdown at prom on a boat as it is sort of going over the Nexus, and the principal, Mr. Pierce, is trying to gain enough power to bring the whole school or even the whole region under their regime which is sort of brainwashing. Kind of, he said that the students who are controlled by the vinculum become model citizens. So that's basically the story, and you also have to deal with the more usual challenges of high school along the way, like keeping your grades up and trying to get scholarships and deciding who to date.
Yeah, it's a bit like, I mean, some of its themes made me think inevitably of a Demon Headmaster.
Yeah.
But obviously an American setting, using those kind of John Hughes style American high school archetypes.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious what routes you went with it.
Well, my first playthrough, I played it very preppily Indeed, I was just as hard working in the game as I was during my own school years. So I won the scholarship, and I did uncover the central mystery. And yeah, I wasn't going to. I didn't cotton to all this teachers brainwashing the school. So I uncovered the mystery and sent them packing, really. So it was a pretty successful playthrough. and I dated my best friend, who seemed like quite a wholesome sort.
Yes.
So and then I started again and tried to play it a bit more like a bad kid.
Yeah.
How about you?
I've done a few, maybe 7 or 8 different playthroughs.
Oh, wow, okay.
Trying to get different endings. I think the creepiest one was probably the one where I ended up getting brainwashed and turning into a pod person.
Ooh, I might have to try that, okay.
That was quite cool. Maki, who suggested, said that the first time she played it, she dated her best friend. Who, the thing with this game is, the genders and the sexualities are flexible on a lot of the characters. So, so you can decide if you want to date girls or boys or both, and then the characters change. But, she was dating her best friend who, as a girl, is called Allison, and Allison became a pod person, but, she stayed with her because she was in love with her. I've never got that ending though. Various things have happened. I've sold drugs. I played one today where I ended up getting arrested, not for selling drugs, but because I was trying to uncover the vinculum, and everyone thought that I'd that it was a bomb and that I planted a bomb, so I ended up going to jail. Before the end of the story. I have this memory, because I played it quite soon after it came out.
Okay.
Back in 2014 or 2015. And I swear, but back then I got like a proper horror ending where, I don't know, like I exploded the vinculum and like I Cronenberged my classmates in some horrible way. And I can't find this ending again. And I don't know if I imagined it.
That makes the game creepier. Like it's some kind of... cursed game with an illicit ending that you can't get.
Yeah. Because that's kind of what I was thinking. I was like, oh, I'm going to try and get that ending. But I've tried a lot of different things, and I can't get anything close to what I remember. So I don't know. I really don't know if that is there or not.
I have to admit, I do want to delve more into it now and do a few more playthroughs, because I guess I didn't realise it branched quite as much as it does.
Yeah, it does. There is quite a lot of a variety in them. Even in the sort of general, the showdown at the end, if you get to the showdown on the boat, there's a few different ways that can go as well. I would recommend.
Yeah, it's fun. I think the writing is quite straightforward. Like, it does what it has to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I've played quite a lot of text games, although more, I guess, from the kind of early 2000s. Like, I try to keep up a little bit, but I don't play them nearly as many. And there are some amazing... like writers within the medium. So Porpentine is probably, one of them. And Porpentine can really write. Like Porpentine can just turn an amazing turn of phrase, for instance. And I've long really loved Emily Short's games particularly, and Adam Kadri's. And I don't think this is up there in terms of that level of writing, but it's really nicely designed. And it does convincingly create that high school environment.
Mm-hmm. And you can date three people at once.
Oh gosh, I was. Yeah, I kept things very simple when I played it. So I would recommend it. It is fun.
Mm. So yeah, I think we will come back to games at some point. There is a Goosebumps game out there.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we keep kind of circling the Goosebumps, and we probably are contractually required to do more Goosebumps. I know there are podcasts just dedicated to Goosebumps, but since we are a long-running podcast now about children's horror, we probably should do more Goosebumps. Or point horror. But, there have been several Goosebumps video games. There's a Goosebumps video games from when we were kids. I don't know if... I think there was a Horrorland one.
Oh, really? Yeah. Okay, that makes sense. Mm.
final recommendation. In terms of not really a proper game and only arguably for kids, I'd say. But my stepdaughter really likes it, and I think played it a few years back. It was another example of me thinking I found something cool that Matt would like, and then being like, oh yeah, I played that, you know, I saw that years ago. Which ever the way, sadly. But it's Petscop.
Okay.
So PETSCOP, which is a series of YouTube videos, supposedly recording a Let's Play of a mysterious PlayStation 1 game called Petscop. So creepypasta style. Now, actually, the guy just made the game for these videos, but the idea is that it's this strange game where you're trying to collect these pets in a pet store or something, and then you find a whole underground world with very strange happenings. And the plot's really loose, with lots of kind of troubling subtextual themes. But the atmosphere is absolutely incredible. It is really unsettling. Without anything graphic, without, you know, any really horrible visuals, a lot of it is just done through the sound design, I'd say. So it has lots of drones, lots of very unsettling drone noises and MIDI music. And I read an interview with the creator, and he said that the biggest influence on it was David Lynch's Inland Empire. So if you imagine a children's horror game or edutainment game directed by David Lynch, that's pretty much what Petscop is. So if that sounds like your speed, then I'd recommend it. If you think that sounds really unsettling and it'll give me nightmares, then don't.
A good rule of thumb.
Yeah.
Cool. I think that's probably everything for this one.
Thank you for indulging me. I know I rambled a bit.
It's all right. I think I covered quite a lot of bases of games there.
Yeah, I think that's probably all of them, all of the children's horror games. But if listener, there are any we didn't cover, please do email us.
I'm sure we'll be interested to know.
And our email is still scared.
stillscaredpodcast@gmail.com.
Thank you. stillscaredpodcast@gmail.com.
We're also on Twitter at Still Scared Pod, and on Instagram at Still Scared Podcast. Our artwork is by Letty Wilson. Our intro music is by Maki Yamazaki, and our outro music is by Joe Kelly. Do you have a sign off for us, Adam?
Yeah, have more fun than a Sierra game, creepy kids.
Good advice. See you later.
Bye.
Bye.